All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What the fucksters? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. Welcome to the show. How's it going? You all right? Oh, come on, man. Don't be that way. Come on. Come on. Open up your heart and let all this, the terror in. Go ahead. Open up your heart and just feel the panic. It's like I'm the worst meditation leader. Hey, everyone, I want everyone to take a deep breath. Yeah, take a deep breath. Let it out through your nose. I think that's the way it goes. That's right, right? Like, clear your mind. Just focus on the day ahead. Focus on the day ahead. Focus on just everything that can go wrong today. Just focus on just the little things. You know, start off small. Like, have you gotten your coffee yet? That could spill on your lap, right? Yeah, I don't even know if I'd stop. Did you stop already? Just, you know, be careful with the coffee. Don't dump that new thermos of coffee onto your lap or onto the car. Don't drop any food onto your lap. Think about all the things that could go wrong today and just dwell on them a minute. Yeah, you could get to work and, you know, your job's not there. Yeah, think about that. Yeah, how's that? You getting angry? You getting aggravated? You getting tense? You getting terrified? Yeah, think about the world. Think about how there's no, you know, we're not part of the Paris Accords anymore and how, you know, we're just going to just push aside all the clean energy entrepreneurial adventures and all the possibilities of clean energy and just reinvest in fossil fuels and coal. Think about that day where all of us will not be able to breathe at the same time, that look we'll have as we go, I guess we're all going together. Think about the peace of that. Think about that, how nobody will miss anything because we'll all be gone in the same few hours. Is this negative? I don't think it's negative. I think it's important to acknowledge and realize this. Think about your own your own time on this planet and how short it is. Breathe in. Open up your heart to this. Open up your heart to just the pure existential terror that we're constantly trying to hide from ourselves. Breathe out. Just breathe out all that peace of mind. Breathe out all of that well-being. Breathe out all that gratitude. Breathe in the darkness and the fear. Am I doing this wrong? Am I doing it wrong? God damn it. I think I'm doing it wrong. All right, folks, look. I didn't mention who was on the show today. Two guests. David Wayne, you know David Wayne from The State, from Stella, from his directorial adventures in film. He's got a new movie. It's about Doug Kenny from the National Lampoon, and it's about that beginning of that magazine. It's called A Futile and Stupid Gesture. It's now streaming on Netflix. He'll be here in a minute. And I was very happy to have Ezra Furman on the show. Ezra Furman has a new album. It's called Trans Angelic Exodus. Comes out on February 9th, and he was just a guy that I don't know. I'll get into it in a minute. What do we need to talk about? Where are we at? The cats are starting to come to the new house. Isn't that odd? I'm sort of dug in over there a bit, kind of still in between houses. Obviously, I'm still in here at the garage, still work getting going on here. But saw a cat on my new front stoop. A cat. They're coming. They know where I am. Word is out. The cats are on the move. On the move. David Wayne and I go back. David Wayne and I go way back to the beginnings of our comedy careers. I didn't know him during The State, but I knew him after when all of those guys started to do stand-up. And it's been a long time since I had him on. He was on a very early WTF, and he's here now to talk about his new film about the National Lampoon, A Futile and Stupid Gesture. Now streaming on Netflix, this is me and David Wayne. So David Wayne, it's been a long time since we chatted.
I looked it up 8 years ago.
Is it really?
Yeah.
8 years ago was the original WTF?
Isn't that incredible?
It's a whole different world. I don't even remember what you were promoting, but
the
you were married.
Changed. I wasn't
happy.
Promoting anything. You ran into me on the street in New York and said, I'm doing a podcast. Come talk to me.
It was that early on?
Oh, yeah. My life was pretty different. Yeah. I lived in New York at the time.
New York, diehard New Yorker.
Yeah. I had a second kid since then.
Right.
I've made like 3 movies. I've done a lot of things. Moved to LA.
You're not married anymore.
Not married. Got divorced.
Wow. A lot has happened.
Yeah.
The entire country has changed for the worse.
The whole country has changed.
Everything's terrifying. And you've made another movie.
And I just made another movie now. Yeah.
I know. That's why you're here. That's what brings you here.
That's
aside
what,
from
that
friendship.
Was the impetus. the what reminded me to want to come was
how,
that.
How long have you lived here?
About 4 years now.
Really?
Yeah. When my oldest son started kindergarten, and I'm like, I was looking at the calendar, and it looks like I'll probably be away 9 months next year.
Right.
In LA.
Yeah.
So I'm like, this is stupid.
How old's that kid now?
He just turned 10.
And how old's the other one?
7. Just today.
They're young kids.
Today's his birthday.
Really? And you're here?
Yeah.
Where's he?
He's in school. I was just at his school.
Oh, it's Friday.
Yeah. I was just giving him and his classmates some donuts.
And is the mom here?
The mom's here too. The mom was there with me.
Uh-huh.
We're friends.
You are?
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
We see each other all the time.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That's nice. And what part of town did you settle in?
Studio City.
Oh, there's some nice homes up there. I know a lot of people that live up there.
Well, coming from New York, I found a little spot where I can walk to the coffee and the pizza.
Do you really do that, David?
I do, because it's really right there. And so I go with my kids. Like this morning, we walked to the little coffee shop for breakfast.
Okay.
For a special birthday breakfast with my kids.
Because I did that when I moved here. I moved over by Franklin, by that one block where the Gelson's is and the old UCB and the Bourgeois Pig and the chicken place. And I was like, this feels like New York. It's like, it's a block. It's 3 stores. Yeah. Within a week, you're driving everywhere.
I didn't feel like it. I don't think it feels like New York, but it's just a nice thing to not have to get in your car sometimes.
Yeah. Rarely, though, right?
Yeah, I go to that strip a lot.
Oh, good. All right. I also
bike a lot. I try to stay on my car.
Oh, I need to exercise. I can't even talk about it. I've been on a shoot for months, and the craft services. I'm just like eating to out of self contempt.
Yeah.
So the National Lampoon movie.
Yeah, A Futile and Stupid Gesture. It's called.
I ended up. I got a screener of it the day before yesterday, and I watched it yesterday because
awesome.
Yeah, my call time was pushed, so I'm like, well, I guess I'll watch David's movie.
I'm so glad you did that.
It's the first one of your movies I've seen in a while. Nothing personal.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah,
I think we live in this great era in our business where there's absolutely no expectation that you've seen your friend's stuff because there's too much stuff out there.
Yeah, and it's sort of like it's a matter of time.
Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, that's right. He did that one. I should get back to that. And also, I think we live in an era where the party's always ongoing. There's no late to the party. You just get back to it.
You're never going to have everything's on all the time.
That's right. Everything's on all the time. But I had an interest in the subject matter. I'm a heavily National Lampoon influenced person.
And are you interested in comedy?
No, that had no pull.
Okay.
The Lampoon, I enjoy. Cool. Yeah, of course I am. But how old are you?
48.
So I'm 54.
Yeah.
Like when I was, I guess the first issue of Lampoon was probably like 71 of National Lampoon,
yeah, 70,
or so.
I think,
1970.
Yeah. Somewhere in there.
With the duck and the woman.
Right.
Like there's a chapter in my life where, I coveted the National Lampoon because I in 1970 I was like 7. But yeah. Like I'd see it on the newsstands and it was always very compelling and lurid and something grown up about it. And then I started reading it around, I can't remember what issue it was, but it was all very mind blowing. It was clearly adult humor.
Yeah.
Because I was a Mad Magazine kid.
Me too.
Right. So like that was the jump, Mad Magazine to National Lampoon.
Right.
And when you made that, you definitely felt like it was a rite of passage. And it was, for me, it was like, 13, probably 14, maybe years old.
Yeah. See, I never quite made the jump. I never felt like I was smart enough. Because I think being just that much younger also, the height of the Lampoon was, it was already kind of declining by the time I was old enough to read it.
Uh-huh.
From my
Oh, I get it. I get it. Yeah. No, it was still pretty vital when I was in it, because it was still the 70s, because I was bar mitzvahed in 76.
Okay, good.
So, it was still, I think it was still at the height, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, at that time it was.
And it was like, I just remember like there were certain things that like stick in my mind. What's the great story where the guy wakes up with a vagina?
Right, yeah.
That was great. I remember the Eddie Bauer catalog satire because of the pictures.
Some of it goes so far, too. It really gets edgy in a way that I don't...
Oh, it's crazy. It was amazing. And the Michael O'Donohue stuff was way out there.
Out of his mind.
And I think I still have the yearbook satire.
Which is awesome.
Which you spent a lot of time on or a little bit of time on in the movie.
Yeah.
And the comics in National Lampoon were great too. And the photo funnies, which you used to you used a lot of devices in the movie to keep it going, keep it moving, keep it funny.
Yeah, and keep it cohesive too.
Well, it was cohesive. You have a timeline there.
Yeah.
But there were some very meta elements that were funny devices that kind of did not distract from the story, and it made it kind of lively.
Well, doing a biopic is an interesting challenge, and I've never done anything like it. So it was
What compelled you? What comedic spirit compelled you?
Well, I mean, there's obvious reasons why I'd be interested in it, because it's about the thing that I do, comedy, and it's kind of like chronicling the generation that came one or two before mine did. And
yeah.
It's our community paying homage to the earlier community. But the project was not initiated by me. Colton and Abood, Michael Colton and John Abood, got together with Peter Principato and John Stern, who were the producers of it. And then they came to me with the book that was written by Josh Karp in 2003. And we've been working though together on it since before they wrote that first draft of the
script.
Is it
a biography of Doug Kenny?
The biography of Doug Kenny, the founder, yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's been almost 10 years we've been working on this together.
Uh-huh.
And trying to crack the nut of how do you tell a whole life story and, you know, how do you put it on film? And it was a really... it was a really cool thing. I've never done anything that was about real people, and some of whom are still alive. And so we together kind of did it.
So so how did you, like, early on, you know, because when you think biopic and you think about biopics, like the one thing that was sort of playing in your favor is that your main character was not as visibly recognizable to most people.
Well, to me, this is one of the big appeals of this.
Yeah.
This is somebody that most people have never heard of.
Right.
And if you're a comedy nerd, maybe, but most people have never even heard the name.
Right.
But he was such a pivotal, central figure in the creation of comedic point of view that we all are part of.
So. Sure. Well, yeah. Going to SNL, to Ivan Reitman, to the film careers of that first crew of SNL people.
Harold Ramis, yeah.
Yeah, and the Lampoon of it in and of itself. It was very interesting. What made you decide to have Martin Mull, in essence, be a non-existent older Doug Kenny? What was that?
The initial impetus was that when I first started talking to the writers about how to shape it, I felt like we should be as outside the box as we can and not just do a plodding, chronological, generic biopic about this guy who was far more interesting than that to me. And I feel like what would Doug Kenny have enjoyed as his own life story?
Yeah.
And also this idea of having the modern Doug Kenny narrate ended up being useful in so many different ways. It helped us to tie together all these disparate episodes.
Yeah.
And it gave it a modern day point of view on all this stuff, which turned out to be pretty important to us, because the humor of it, you know, it has its own, it exists in a time and a place, in a context. It's not all of it is funny in the way that it would be if you were saying, like, here it is today. So
you think so?
Well, it depends. I mean, certainly there's plenty of stuff in, if you think about it, you look at the first season of SNL, the same thing. There's some stuff that just doesn't feel as funny just because it feels old or not fresh, and other things have changed because of the cultural lives have changed. Certainly, everyone's talked, you know, people talk a lot about how misogynist it was, which is true. It's hard to, you can't deny it.
But it seems like if you contextualize some of the more poignant and pointed satire from National Lampoon, you know, it's worth its weight. You know, they weren't pulling any punches, and in some ways, you know, it was meant to go beyond funny to just tasteless.
Oh yeah, and they were looking to push boundaries.
Yeah,
sometimes more than be funny.
Right. Yeah, because there's that great scene with Matt Walsh as Maddie Simmons. That's Maddie.
Yeah.
Is it Maddie? Comes running down the hall in a montage of people suing.
Right. Everyone sued them.
Yeah.
And you know that they got off on that. You know, they were all about how exciting that was.
But I noticed that there were, am I wrong in that, were there actors from Animal House, secondary actors from Animal House in the film? Like, was the woman on the tour bus?
The tour bus.
Was one of the cheerleaders?
Martha Smith, who was the one who, at the end of Animal House,
it
says,
not the cheerleader, Babs. The
Omega
sorority
girlfriend. Yeah.
And was the guy who played Niedermeyer?
Right.
He was one of the executives,
and so we tried to, you know, and made a little reference. And in fact, he says in the movie, "What are you going to do with your life?"
Right,
which is a reference to that Twisted Sister music video that he.
Yeah, made. Yeah, right.
So, you know, we like to just. We thought, why not have fun with this? We wanted to. In anything I do, I try to not take it too seriously in the wrong way, but take it seriously in the right way.
You know? You did. How were the facts? Were they tight? I mean, did you bend the truth at all?
It was so exhaustively researched, and we knew everything that we were doing and what was right and what was wrong. But then we knew there's a part in the middle of the movie where we list all the things that we changed for dramatic reasons, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's plenty of things in there that either we don't know or that we changed to tell a more clear story. And that's just, I think, what you have to do. And
we had, all these people that we, Joe's in it.
Joe Lucilio, yeah, Tom Lennon.
Tom Lennon was great.
Michael O'Donohue.
He was great.
Really inspired, yeah.
It was really a good performance.
He's amazing.
Because there is footage of Michael. You know, there's plenty of footage of Michael.
Well, anyone who watched SNL in the early days knows him.
Or that fucked up movie he made.
Right.
Mondo Video. Do you remember that?
Yeah, Mr. Mike's Mondo Video.
That was crazy.
I remember watching that late night on VHS.
Like, what the fuck is this?
Well, that guy was out of his mind in the best way.
Joel McHale played Chevy.
Jackie Tone
played Gilda
Radner. And all those people, I mean, every one of those characters and those performances, we didn't have room to do much with any one character. And I would love to see a whole movie with these same casts, even of the early stages of SNL.
Yeah, John Daly. Was that John?
Yeah, John Daly playing Bill Murray.
That was good. He did a great job.
Yeah.
But I was surprised Tom Lennon was really, you know.
He really...
he locked in. And Natasha
Lyonne played Ann Beats.
Yeah, and Matt Walsh was there. Yeah, it was powerhouse.
Sounds like an amazing cast.
Comedy ensemble.
Wow.
Yeah, everybody was represented there.
It was cool. And Emmy Rossum plays a key role as his girlfriend, Catherine Walker.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I thought that, who played the guy? Who played Beard?
Henry Beard is Donald Gleason, who you might even not recognize, but he's like one of the top actors. Now he's the guy in Star Wars who plays the redheaded... Colonel, and he's been in a million he's been in like 6 or 7 movies.
Oh wait,
this
was
year.
That him with the from The Revenant?
Yes, Donald Gleason.
Oh, he's in everything.
Yeah, he's an Irish redheaded actor, but he's almost unrecognizable in this.
Yeah, no, he's great. Yeah. That guy's in everything. Yeah, I thought that was a good, because I'd seen the documentary recently.
Right. Drunk, Stoned, Brilliant Dead.
Yeah, yeah, that's, yeah. I don't, that, where did that go? It just seemed to be...
It was, people saw, it was it had a, it was like all documentaries, it had maybe a tiny release in theaters, but it was on Netflix and a lot of people saw it. I thought it was awesome.
I found myself very impressed towards the end of the movie with the transportation of the cocaine in a tennis ball. like for some reason that detail is like, wow.
That was true, yeah.
It was true?
Yeah, and also what was the story we heard about Chevy Chase having this very fancy case where he kept all his cocaine and all the paraphernalia in a really like, as if it was the bomb, you know, it was amazing.
So I like how you went through all the stuff that they were sort of, you know, the pitch meetings and then the type of stuff they were satirizing, the enemies, because this was an intimate media landscape where, you know, the magazine like that could have some impact and effect.
Yeah, it's a different time. That's another thing I tried to communicate to maybe younger audiences is magazines were huge.
Like, yeah.
And Lampoon was really the voice of counterculture. There wasn't anything on TV like that until Saturday Night Live came along.
Right. And it was still like sometimes, and you used the photo funnies to document the dissolving of his marriage. That was clever. Photo funnies were important.
The photo funnies were amazing. I mean, for people who might not know, they would take these little dumb photographs in their office and then turn them into comic strips.
Yeah.
Not even turn, just like literally write little comic balloons on them
and
make these dumb jokes. And they became very popular and often had boobs.
Yeah, a lot of boobs. Yeah, yeah. It was good because if you couldn't get hold of a Playboy as a 13-year-old, you know, you could get those into the house. You could get National Lampoon into
the
house.
And that was really, like, that was the window. That was why so many people ended up ultimately picking that up.
Because of the boobs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like why I watched John Viner's Bazaar on Showtime, because it had boobs in 1981.
Yeah. Oh, did it?
Do you remember that? It was the first cable show that I was aware of on a premium network, and they actually had sketches, and every... two sketches, somebody would take their shirt off for a second, and it was incredible.
It was important.
Even if you didn't pay for Showtime and it was scrambled, you'd wait for a minute to unscramble for a second.
So what did you ultimately learn? What was it in this process about comedy or about yourself or about anything? Anything? Like, I mean, how long did it take to shoot that thing?
Well, it took, I don't know, 20 some days to shoot, maybe 30 some days to shoot. And, but it was a long gestating thing because we spent, you know, years and years putting it together and thinking about it. And then we actually stopped for 6 months during the editing so that I could, and a lot of us could leave and then spend, the time writing, prepping, shooting, editing, and releasing the Wet Hot American Summer miniseries, the second one on Netflix, 10 years later. But anyway, the point is we had a big chunk of time away from the movie, which was really helpful for us to understand, because a movie like this has so many different parts and modules and ways to attack it. So
yeah.
we did a lot of creative storytelling thoughts work in the editing.
Yeah.
And did a couple days of reshoots and then finally put it all together.
Could you have ever imagined that camp movie would be a franchisable business?
Of course not. I remember when we were shooting it, I was praying we'd have enough money to finish shooting it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I was never sure it would even come out in any form.
And now it's developed this like loyal cult and aging following. It's, I have to assume,
insane.
That a lot of the people it was a defining movie for have got to be almost 50.
Well, yeah, they're getting it. Well, yeah, we are. But I'm happy to say younger people seem to like it too, but it's, who knew?
Is that camp experience still the same, you think?
No.
I mean, give or take? No,
not at all. It's, I think the liability insurance actually changed camp's experience a lot. And parents have expectations for their kids to have all sorts of computers and stuff.
Oh, that's right.
And then some are going the
better
other direction.
Better vetting of counselors.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, the looseness,
yeah.
which I remember so fondly at my camp, is just would never fly today.
Right.
Yeah, it was loose and ramshackle, and like we would just sit around all day.
And all the counselors were fucking each other.
And there was no like sending photos back to parents. Like nobody knew what was happening.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
It's a secret place. You'd get a box from your parents every once in a while.
You'd hang around all day, go make out all night, and then come home at the end of the summer. And I remember coming back from my summer and I didn't realize how dirty my mouth had become at all.
Yeah.
And I'd say to my mom, oh, I had a fucking great time. Fuck mom, fuck this, fuck that. Yeah. My parents were like, what the hell?
What happened? What kind of camp did we send him to? Now, wait, is there a plan for another eight? What hot?
Not at the moment. We sort of put a little.
You've done 16 total?
We did 16 half hours plus the movie.
Yeah.
And the last one was the 10 years later, which ended, has a bit of an ending to it if you watch it sometime. And I think we have other ideas to now expand in other ways in the WHU, the Wet Hot Universe.
Mm-hmm.
But
is that what you call it in the office?
That's what I'm starting to call it now.
Okay.
Putting that out there. So we're just exploring that now, and we'll see, probably down the line somewhere.
Now, do you keep in touch with all the other state people? I have to ask you that.
We still work together all the time in different configurations.
I saw Showalter the other night.
Yeah.
I guess I didn't realize or put it together that he directed The Big Sick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an amazing achievement this year.
I saw him at the Critics' Choice.
And he also does that show Search Party.
Yeah.
And we did Wet Hot together. He had a great, crazy year.
Yeah, good. And, because out of a lot of you, he looked like he had a tough year or two.
Well, everyone, it's like one of those horse races where at the fair where the one comes ahead, and it's like everybody has their moments that they.
We
come
just want everyone to keep working.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. There was a period there where I'm like, oh, is he just going to be a professor?
Yeah,
you know, and then all of a sudden, no.
I think it's cool that you got all of us on your show.
I think I did. Did I?
I think you did. Got them all, or maybe not Todd Hollebeck.
He's the outsider, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he moved to Korea, but he was the founder.
I know, but it doesn't seem like it's good. Is it good? Is everybody okay? Is he good?
Oh, yeah, he's fine. I mean, he's come back. You know, we've done some things as the entire group in recent years. We did a Festival Supreme show, and we did some new material. And
I think I only had Ben on a live one. Did I do a one-on-one with Tom, or did I have Tom and Ben? I think I did do a one-on-one with Tom.
Yes, you did.
And then I had the two of them, and Joe, and Michael Ian Black, and
Carrie,
yeah.
Kevin.
Kevin, yeah. I think I did get most of them.
Oh, maybe, and Marino?
Yes, I did a one-on-one with Marino. Yeah, and then he was in my TV show, too.
But what have you done, 800 of these?
Almost 900.
So you're not going to,
I'm at the place where I don't know.
But aren't you at the place also where someone could say a name and you'll be like, I don't know that name. And you're like, but he was a guest on your show.
I usually know the name, but sometimes I'm not sure if we did one.
Right. It's a lot of episodes.
Right?
Yeah. I definitely am at the point, I guess I'm grateful, where I forget whole things I did. Like somebody said, you know, I worked with you on blah, blah show. And I'm like, I don't even know if I remember what that is. You know?
Oh my God, we're getting old.
But it's good. It means that we're not luxuriating in the past.
Or dead.
Yet.
Yeah. All right, buddy. It's good talking to you. Congrats on the movie. Good luck with it.
Thank you.
That was me and Mr. David Wayne. The movie is fun and it's educational in parts. You'll learn. If you didn't see that documentary too on the National Lampoon, forget what it's called. You should watch that as a primer. Is that the word I want? A primer. Get your pump primed with some Lampoon shit. Changed my life, that magazine. Changed my life. So, oh yeah, I got an email. Mark, email. Rita Moreno, the worst whooping I ever got. That's the subject line. Hey, Mark. Thanks for years of enjoyment with the podcast, comedy sets here in Charlotte, and the TV shows. In about 1978, I was 5 years old and downstairs with my little sister and brother watching The Electric Company. My memory is of Rita Moreno as the director teaching us about punctuation. She concluded the lesson by raising her megaphone and shouting, "The TV is on fire!" to show us what an exclamation was. So to show what I'd learned, I walked up into the kitchen and yelled, "The TV is on fire," at my parents. My dad took off like a shot down the stairs, and when he came back up, I didn't get a chance to explain at all. I still remember that as the worst spanking in a childhood that definitely deserved some spankings. Thanks again and take care, Doug. Doug, I got to say, it didn't sound like you deserved that one. And I think, you know, I'm glad you got this out. I'm glad you had this memory, but I think maybe if your father's still alive, you might want to discuss this and explain to him exactly what happened, and just maybe get a little bit of that, a little piece of apology, just a little bit. You didn't get a chance. He jumped the gun. You learned something. I don't know how you feel about exclamation points now. Do you avoid them? Do you avoid yelling because of that? Do you get a twitch when you text someone an exclamation point or write an exclamation point? I don't know, man. It sounds like I would take this email and read it to your father. That's what I would do. So Ezra Furman, look, this kid, I don't know. Like, I got some records and there was something to him. It's really how it happened. I think I got his first two records. And I, you know, there's a lot of kind of structurally familiar stuff. You know, it's good. It's good rock, definitely rocks. But there's something really amazing about his songwriting, about his passion, and about his rawness, man. He just, like, it was one of these. It was like Phil Elverum, but different, because that was painfully sad. But and I had him on to talk about his album, but. But Ezra just sort of, like, you know, there was something, some songs were kind of 50s-ish, and some, it just, there was a lot of familiar drive to them, but unique songwriting, unique voice, and just the passion and the rawness of it. Just, it got me going. So I'm like, well, who is this kid? Who is this kid from Chicago? So I asked him to come on the show. As I said earlier, Ezra's got a new record out called Trans Angelic Exodus. It's actually out February 9th. And this is me talking to Ezra Furman. And now you're going out for the big tour. You're going to Europe?
Yeah, Europe, USA. Yeah, the first chunk is just a solid 2 months away. Two plus months.
And what are you afraid of?
So I break down. I break down on tour.
Yeah.
I have fun, but, like, yeah. if I'm not like sleeping,
yeah,
I go insane like right away.
Oh, really?
And I'm like,
first week.
It's like 2 weeks in usually.
Yeah.
Really start to skate along the bottom of my psyche.
How does that manifest itself?
You got your depression.
Yeah.
And you got your anxiety.
Yeah.
And then, like, there's sometimes it's between those two things.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just like lying on the back bench of a van and someone's like, "It's time to sound check." Yeah. And I'm like, "I can't do anything."
Oh, really?
And that kind of breaking down.
And then
there's like, yeah, just anxiety in different modes.
Like panic about things not going well, or dread?
It's a lot of stage fright sometimes, but more often it's not about anything.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think I have some kind of panic disorder. I've had like panic attacks that get kind of heavy and serious.
Like got to breathe in a bag kind of thing?
Is that what people do?
I mean, that's old school.
No, I just like...
If you can't catch your breath, You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Breathing.
My chest.
Remembering to breathe, I guess.
Right. Yeah. My chest tightens up. That's where I go out of my anxiety. Like I can feel like can't get a deep breath.
But I've learned some skills.
Yeah.
I've gotten way better with that.
Like what? What do you do? Would you get ground yourself? Kinda.
Well, yeah. At some point I learned that what gets it going is that you feel it coming on and like this is bad, something bad is happening, everything's wrong, I'm losing my mind, and it's actually being afraid of it that makes it a problem. Whereas if you just like here it is, it feels bad, but it's just my brain doing a little thing, and
right?
It goes away, and like that really makes a huge
kind of separate yourself from it. As opposed to feed into it. Like, it's not the truth. It's just my brain.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, because I used to think like, oh, wait, something's dawning about me about what it is to be alive.
Right,
everything's actually horrible and I have been ignoring it.
Your muse. Like, it's your muse that you're ignoring.
It's
the dark, depressing void muse.
The void muse.
Ooh, yeah.
That's a good, like... metal band name.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm fine with it. So you have a big following in Europe. How's it working for you out there?
They so far care about us more in England and Europe,
and it's been that way from the beginning.
Well, at the beginning obviously nobody cared about us at all, and no, the first weird thing is that we somehow had this when I was with my other band, my first band was called Ezra Furman and the Harpoons.
Yeah, yeah. Three records worth?
Yeah, and we formed that band in college, when I was in college.
Which college?
Tufts University in Boston.
I know where that is. I used to live down the street from there.
Oh, really? Where'd you live?
I lived on Cottage Ave in Somerville, a couple blocks down from Redbones.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Like Davis Square. I lived in Davis Square before it was cute.
It's really cute, isn't it?
Did you grow up in New England?
No, I grew up in Chicago.
You're a Chicago guy?
Well, Evanston.
Uh-huh.
I should say I'm from Evanston.
Uh-huh.
I've been trying to say Evanston because that's where I'm from, the first suburb north of Chicago.
So how'd you grow up? Like they're like Jewish? You talk about being Jewish in the music.
Yes.
How many of you are there? You Jews, you Jewish Furmans.
I'm from a family of six. I have
six kids.
Four.
Okay,
four kids.
Yeah,
three siblings.
Yeah,
yeah. My parents are liberal Jews, but as a child of Holocaust refugees.
Really?
And he grew up
your
in Boston.
Grandparents.
My dad's parents escaped. They weren't in concentration camps.
Got out under the wire.
Yeah, really.
Did you know him?
I didn't know my grandmother. I knew my grandfather.
Oh yeah.
A haunted man.
Yeah.
How
old were you?
Also very sweet.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Did
grandpa to me.
Could you tell he was haunted, or you felt that from him?
Well, I just remember, kind of learning about what the Holocaust was, and then, I think maybe some teacher. It encouraged me, like, yeah, you should go ask your grandfather about his story.
Uh-huh.
And I tried to ask him, and he just, I think, immediately broke down crying and couldn't speak, you know? And just like, so, and it was this mysterious thing, like something. And I never really got the whole story of his childhood. I think he was like 7 years old or something, and the Nazis were invading, and they left home. They're like, let's get out of here.
Yeah.
And so, like, to me, that's always like, there was a message of that, of like, they were paranoid enough, you know?
They got out ahead of the curve.
They survived. I bet all their friends were like, you're overreacting, you know?
Yeah.
So that makes me a paranoid person.
Yeah, I'm paranoid.
It's inherited.
Yeah. And how old were you when that incident, what's
when
grade?
I talked to him?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Like really young?
Maybe I was 10 years old.
Oh, yeah. So it's a real memory.
Yeah.
Are you the oldest kid?
I'm the second of four.
You have an older what?
Older brother.
Younger brother who was in a band?
Yes, that's right. Jonah Furman of the band Krill.
Yeah, he's got some fans at Krill.
Yeah, they're now they broke up.
I know.
He put a hard end on that band. He was, it's over. And then he went to go do get into the labor movement.
Oh, so he's
and,
gonna
and unions. He worked on this Teamsters election of the underdog candidate.
Oh, really? So he's a volunteer or is he an administrator in the labor movement? What does he do?
So now
he's a lawyer or what?
He's not a lawyer. He's working like for the New Jersey Teachers Union.
Oh, yeah.
And trying to unionize teachers and grad students. Yeah, he's doing cool stuff. It was a impressive transition.
Well, did the rock dream die for him, or did he felt like he wasn't doing enough?
It didn't die. He was like, we did it. We did our band, and I think he was making a new record, and he was like, it's kind of the same as the last one, and then they were all just like, I think that we want to do other things with our lives than just go from dive bar to dive bar, rocking out. Yeah.
Right. And it was different. Very different musically. Obviously, you're different people.
Oh, yeah.
But I listened to some of it. It's more of it's a trio, right?
Yeah.
And they do
Trio.
Power Trio, almost like there's a little Pavement influence, a little Minutemen,
They get noisy.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Strange.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Odd time signatures. And
right.
Cool stuff that really I admire and impresses me because I'm just so terminally three chord oriented.
I love that about you.
Well,
I think that's why the first record hit me. It was sort of like, this guy's got a respect for that 1-4-5 business.
That's right. It still works.
Well, it does, but there's so many almost homages to that era of rock and roll that you do. It reminds me a lot too of the New York scene, the first wave of punk rock. You know, they sort of, Ramones, the Dolls,
oh, yeah.
The Heads. You know, a lot of those, a lot of them played with that stuff.
Well, that stuff is kind of where I come from. It was the first music I loved.
Is
punk. I mean, my the thing at 12 years old,
yeah,
that made me realize that I was like more than a little bit into music was Green Day. And then that's a good game. That's a great, first of all, that is
the first
music
album? Was it Dookie?
It was Dookie that got me. That's the music for a hyperactive 12 year old. It's so perfect.
Yeah.
And then of course, to read about them, you just it's this branching path. They're like, oh, who are the Sex Pistols? The Clash?
They were the portal.
Yeah.
Into the punk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, so I thought that was my destiny, was to be a punk rocker. And then some other stuff kind of took me by surprise. Bob Dylan.
A lot of Dylan in the early records, the early Furman records.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's
you
right.
can definitely hear it. And there's also some there's some sort of Phil Spector-y, Springsteen-y kind of thing too, maybe? A hint of it?
Mm-hmm.
Did that do anything for you?
I got really, the Ronettes hit me and I was like, right. Oh wait, no, this is the thing. It was just thing after thing, no, wait, this is it.
Yeah.
And then I grew up listening to mix CDs and mixtapes and...
Violent Femmes?
I can't focus is the thing.
Yeah.
I heard about the Violent Femmes because somebody saw me play at an open mic and they were like, oh man, it's great. You love the Violent Femmes, don't you? And I was like, Violent, let me write that down.
Well, you sound a little like him sometimes, like Gano, like
some
Gordon.
Some of us are just blessed with the golden Gano voice.
It's nasal. Well, you don't do it all the time though. It's almost like when you hit a certain note, you're reminiscent of it, and there's a rawness to that. There the familiarity of that, of whatever he does, which isn't a lot, it definitely delivers. I don't listen to many rock guys' words, but I have to listen to you. And it's nice, it's good, it's not a bad thing.
Yeah, that,
but your voice is very commanding.
That's a Gordon Gano thing and a Johnny Rotten Sex Pistols thing, that enunciation.
Uh-huh.
I remember I saw Johnny Rotten on on TV, on like a VH1 thing or something. Yeah. And I was like, the way that he's, everything he's doing is who I am, you know? And it, that's how I felt at age 12.
Angry? You're angry?
Yeah, and just like, and wanting to make sure you knew what the fuck he was saying, you know? He'll, an antichrist.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
He'll, he really gives you all those consonants.
Sure, yeah. The enunciation is very important.
Yeah, I believe in it.
Yeah, no.
I'm a words guy also. I feel like I'm a writer.
You definitely
are.
That's
the first thing. I mean, that's what I thought I would be when I was a kid. I was into creative writing.
Yeah. But there, no, you definitely write the shit out of songs. There's no question about it. And there's like certain, like, yeah, right at the very beginning, you know, you take on big themes and you move through, you know, very, you know, Dylan-esque kind of turns of phrase and long narratives. It's great. And then you filter in the sort of like bebop stuff, and then you filter in a little like, you know, good old time Buddy Holly rock, and you know, you
just, sure,
you go through all of it.
I mean, I've diagnosed with ADHD at age 16, so it's musically expressed, you know.
Yeah.
I can't focus. I sometimes feel like I should have just choose a sound and stay with it, Ezra, just like,
yeah.
But
you do the oddly still, you do have that.
I think a mood and a kind of worldview hangs over it all,
but a tone too. I mean, just, you know, because of the way you got a very urgent sensibility.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, that kind of, you know, moves through all of it, no matter what style you're playing in. What about your other sibs? What are they doing? All boys?
No, I my sister, I have a younger sister. Older brother, younger sister, younger brother.
What's the older brother up to?
He's an artist. So we're all artsy types somehow, and our
like a painter or what kind of?
He's a visual artist, a painter, sculptor.
In Chicago?
Well, he lives in New York now.
Yeah.
Actually, Jersey City.
Jersey City. Home of the former Maxwells.
That's right.
That's Hoboken.
No,
that's
Hoboken. Hoboken.
Yeah.
But yeah, that kind of.
I was born in Jersey City.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I did, but that was really the last time I spent any real time there.
I hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was nice.
I hope you enjoyed your time.
I did all right, yeah. My dad was from there. Jersey. Uh-huh. So what'd your dad do?
Nothing artsy. A stock options trader at the Chicago Board of Trade.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Still like around?
The stuff that numbs my mind.
Yeah. Is he still around?
He's still around, yes.
Yeah.
He's,
you guys get along?
We do. I'm one of the lucky ones.
Yeah?
I really do.
Out of your family or in general?
In general, in this world. I think our family is like really, it's just one of those close families. I mean, we had all kinds of troubles and conflicts growing up, and they really faded away, and we just are just tight. We're buddies.
All of you?
All of us.
What's your sister do?
She's a poet. I mean, so now she's... I don't know how we all turn into artists like that, because parents are not, they don't seem particularly artsy, although my mom does do like a poetry group and writes poems in her spare time, kind of.
Uh-huh. So your sister's a serious poet.
Yeah, well, she got the whole MFA, and she's a serious poet. But she's living in Nashville, and she's working... at Vanderbilt University, I think.
Uh-huh. Teaching?
Not teaching. Doing administrative stuff.
She likes it down there?
She loves Nashville, yeah.
Yeah?
You
like
it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do too. I like the city, yeah.
It can be a tough music town.
Sure.
There's a lot of people who... I don't know. There's tons of musicians there, and then some people, sometimes they get a little snobby about it.
Sure. Yeah, it's a real industry town of a certain industry. I don't hear much country in your catalog.
Yeah, it's
like the, it's not like I've noticed, like I know I can hear a lot of the bebop, the Dylan, the old-time rock and roll, some ballady stuff, but like there's nothing, you know, noticeably twangy.
I'm so
missing
suburban.
Something?
I'm I'm very
did I miss one? And,
yeah.
Is there a twanger on
there? There's some twangy moments. I've written some country-esque weepers.
You did?
Like that one. There's one called Hour of Deepest Need.
Uh-huh.
That's...
Well, I guess Dylan had a lot of country elements too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Hour of Deepest
Need. I mean, if you're trying to be... I mean, like I am trying to be a student of the great songwriters. So, you know, you gotta go to Townes Van Zandt, et cetera, some point.
Yeah, you can only dip in, don't go in too long.
That's right.
For any one time.
I know.
You come out real sad.
Sense an enveloping darkness there.
Oh my God. You can feel it right away.
I know.
Like, before you even start singing. Have you ever seen video of them where it's just sort of it's like fucking heartbreaking.
I know.
It's like just drowning in liquor.
Yeah. It's very upsetting.
What was your first Dylan experience?
So that was a special thing because I was like, I wanted to get a guitar and play punk songs.
Right.
You know? And my mom was like, we'll get you a guitar.
Yeah.
You're going to get an acoustic guitar and you're going to learn some songs that we like. Right?
Here's your song.
And
book,
so she got me a book of Bob Dylan songs, chords,
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I will listen to one of these songs and learn to play it and show my mom and I'll be off the hook.
Yeah.
And then so that I went, it was an alphabetically organized thing. So I went to the first song, Absolutely Sweet Marie, found my parents' Blonde on Blonde CD. And I was like, okay, what's this? How would I do it? And then, suddenly it's like this, wait a second.
It's all here.
I hear that again. And then,
Visions
Blonde
of Joanna
became my thing. Then that's what started like,
Blonde on Blonde.
I want to be a great writer. I want to be like a
Visions of Joanna is like one of my favorite songs ever.
That shit is incredible.
It's insane, man. It's like everything's in there.
I know.
There's so many songs of Dylan's where you're like, it's all here. Everything. All questions are answered.
He's a special guy. And by that time, he's sort of like, he's built this world where he can do anything. And on Blonde on Blonde, he's just like, he's moved all the parameters.
Yeah.
He's broken down all the fences and now he's got like a playground to make this giant double record on. The songs feel like there's everything in there.
So when did you first start writing the songs? How old were you?
I guess I was 14.
Uh-huh.
It was just taking that Dylan songbook and changing the words and then changing a few chords. Like I would take a song and do it exactly, but it'd be a song I never heard, so I didn't know actually how it went.
Right.
And then I'd change all the words, and then I've got it. Then I wrote a song.
So you figured out how the way he rhymes, the way it works with him. I mean, it's a very specific way he turns phrases. Like, it's the poet's game that, no one writes songs like him, really.
Yeah.
Right?
And it's not the just thing, a, I mean, it's, I'm amazed that I stuck with it, because...
With Dylan?
Well, actually with writing songs, because I was really, from the get-go, I could not sing well at all. And my parents tell me now, like, they were really
concerned.
They were like, should we take that away from him? Because like, we can't allow him to think that he's good at this. He won't stop making that sound.
they told you that?
They told me much later.
Yeah.
They were like, let him figure it out.
Uh-huh.
But I was content to be bad at it for a long time.
Well, Dylan, there's a lot of people that would argue he's a horrible singer.
That's crazy. He's an amazing singer. He's got control. He's got an unusual voice, but...
No, I agree.
He knows what he's
and
doing.
And he's played around with it over the years. So you were writing at 14. Did any of those songs remain? Did they keep... Did any of them make the first record from when you were a kid?
I think the first one that I kept and eventually released, I probably wrote when I was just... 16.
Yeah. On the first record?
On the first record, like stuff like American Highway.
Uh-huh.
Which, it makes me kind of cringe now, but it's...
Does it?
A little bit. Yeah. Actually, that's not right to say. It's just you nitpick your old stuff.
Of course. You could have done something differently.
Right. I would now, but it was...
But I don't know. Like, I mean, I listened to a lot of them, and I listened to them, you know, recently. You know, there's a lot of interesting ideas on that first record, that, like, God is a Middle-Aged Woman. That's a good song. And My Soul Has Escaped My Body. That's a good one.
It was very alive.
Yeah. You're all jacked up.
I cringe also because I didn't care that I was, like, singing way out of tune or whatever. I mean, I remember at that point, I didn't care about anything musical. Like, we would do the first take of the song, and I'd be like, okay, next song. And, you know, the guy recording it, he's like, maybe we should do it a few more times. Yeah. And I'm like, what? We did it already. It was cool.
Yeah. Well, that's good, though. Well, where'd you record that thing, though? Were you in college or was it after college? Were you?
It was during college, yeah.
So you somehow, were like, you were like, what, 19?
When we recorded, I think I'd turned 20. Yeah, but we formed the band when I was 19.
Who are those guys? Any of those guys play with you anymore?
No, I see them from time to time. And
are they still in the game? In the music game?
No, they really got out, and they're all kind of much happier.
Really?
No, I mean, I feel like they were all like, you're good at this. You're going to maybe be in this for life. We're gonna go, like, become lawyers.
Did you do those? They became lawyers.
Well, one of them's a lawyer. Yeah.
So you Good. Guys did those first two or three records all when you were in college, and they were able to sort of like that was a college thing. Good luck with everything.
And then we did a few years after college, and they were starting to be like, is this really my life? Like,
right?
You know, because it's like.
It's a heavy commitment.
People didn't care about our band.
Right.
We didn't make money. We
You didn't have a following in Boston? You didn't, I mean,
a little following. We could maybe sell out the upstairs Middle East.
Oh, upstairs?
Upstairs, the little room at the Middle East.
Oh yeah.
Or fill it anyway, but yeah.
We weren't launching or anything.
It's like a couple blogs that liked us, and that was enough to keep us going somehow.
So they peel away, and then you do the solo record? You do three records with the Harpoons in
three
college?
And
where'd
ton.
You record them? In your house?
Well, we did a demo in a dorm room, and then, no, we got a record deal. That's the shocking thing. It's we formed the band, and we were like, well, we could get summer jobs or, like, take summer school classes, or we could go on tour this summer.
Yeah.
Because I had a friend who became my manager, Mitch Marlowe, a hero of my of my life, who was like, you could
in college. You met that guy?
I actually met him in high school.
For a Chicago guy?
A Chicago guy.
Yeah.
He saw me play at an open mic, which I used to do all the time.
When you were in high school?
When I was in high school, actually, I'd go usually with my dad to down the street to a bar. Because I couldn't get in alone.
So you're just acoustic guitaring it?
I'd play acoustic guitar and, you know, surprise all the like, 35-year-old dudes who are at the open mic.
Right.
And like, that kid, oh, that was kind of interesting.
Uh-huh.
And so, I met this guy, Mitch, and he was like, if you ever want to, you know, do a real music career with this, I can help. I, like, manage another band. I could manage you if you want.
Who was his other band?
They were called the Red Walls.
Uh-huh.
Which they were a great, very old, like, kind of 60s sound and garage group from Chicago suburbs, and they were fantastic.
So he took you on.
So he took us on once we had formed a band, and he was like, I'll call in some favors, get you on, like, First of Three at various dive bars across the Midwest, you know?
Yeah, First of Three. I never heard that term. I like it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's a rough spot.
Or, yeah, maybe First of Five.
Yeah.
And some of the bars made us stand outside because, you know, we weren't old enough to drink. So,
my God.
You wait till you play, then you get out.
Yeah. No one's closing us down because of you kids.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the shocking thing was that he got a Chicago indie label's vice president or A&R guy to come to our show in Chicago, and they were like, that was an amazing show, you're signed, let's do it.
With the Harpoons, you guys traveled over the summer.
Mm-hmm.
You got the other, where are all those other guys from? around the
Iowa,
East Coast,
Philadelphia. Oh, yeah. We met at Tufts.
Sure, right. That's right. Yeah. But they're all different places. But you got some chops playing around Boston. Then you went and did the gig in Chicago, and you get signed.
I wouldn't call them chops, and we got signed somehow, and that was very shocking to us. It was like, the thing with me is like my highest ambition was to record something and like be on somebody's mixtape that they gave to their friend. Like, I was like, if that could happen, that would be making it.
I think that's happened.
And that happened very quickly. And I was left with the problem of like, oh, what is there other things I want out of this? Do I?
You made some mixtapes. Yeah, some people put you on a mixtape and you're like, am I done?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it didn't occur to me that like this could be my career.
Yeah.
I thought that was like a one in a million thing.
Yeah.
That you like somehow become famous and you're in a band. I was a dumb.
So once you ask yourself those questions, so how long, over how many years did you do the first three records? 2 years?
Oh, 07, 08, and 010, I guess.
Uh-huh. And you were writing all the songs.
Yeah.
How bad could you have the attention deficit disorder if you can kind of hold it together to play music and write songs? Or is that what focused
you? I mean, I thought maybe I was going to be like a novelist. I could only concentrate to write like a 3-minute thing.
But that takes hours sometimes, doesn't it?
I mean, yeah, true. That's true. I've got some...
Like even like on the solo record, like American Soil, which is a great song, that must have taken days.
That took some time. That by then I started to edit, you know?
Yeah.
When I first started, I was like, I would write the song in one sitting.
Uh-huh.
And then just go with it? And then it's like, it's done.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was also, my goal then was to write a song every week. If I felt very disappointed in myself if I didn't write a song a week.
Yeah, so that's a work ethic.
Yeah, nobody told me, like, that's a lot more than most people write.
But it paid off. I mean, you put a lot on vinyl. You put a lot on, you laid a lot of tracks down. Do you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So,
I mean, the other thing is, like, I had my foot out the door a lot of the time because I wasn't, in college, I thought I was going to do comedy, which I wanted to mention to you because it was like the road not taken for me.
Really?
Because I was in a sketch group in college.
Really?
And I would like write humor articles and stuff for the newspaper when I was in high school. Yeah, I really almost did it. I saw people coming out of that and going into comedy.
Did you try stand-up?
I didn't try stand-up. I did. I was kind of into improv. I also used to go to Chicago Improv a lot and I.O., and that was so fascinating to me.
But do you never tried stand-up?
I never tried stand-up. I was just interested. It's interesting to me why I went away from it. I think I didn't get along with those comedy guys.
Uh-huh.
And it was
too rough for you?
It was too bro-y, and like, yeah. I was like, do we ever get to connect in a serious way with each other, or is everything like a bit? You know, like, I just knew all these guys who were always on, and
you have to learn how to decode it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think I just like, ultimately, it's not my instinct to poke holes in pretentious things. I think that's the comics. That's what you want to, that's what comedy people want to do. And I just like being serious. And
but you do it though. I mean, I understand what you're saying is that I think that the you know what comedy does as far as, you know, truth to power or confronting you know, big ideas and big topics or hypocrisy or any of the stuff that comedy is fueled against, you do with your songs. Maybe comedy was too limited for you.
I'm not sure about that.
I mean, you know, Dylan is pretty funny, but Dylan can be very serious, and a turn of a phrase, you know, that packs a punch. It doesn't have to be funny.
I mean, that's my favorite. Like I like Kyle Kinane because of his turns of phrase. You know,
uh-huh,
I mean, he writes those sentences. Like, oh, I like people who play with words. That's my favorite thing.
But you can do, but you know, it doesn't have to be funny. I mean, but I understand that maybe the community was a little too harsh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're harsh and I don't know. Maybe I was also too pretentious for it. You know, I've got a pretentious streak. Like, I'm an artist.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, it also seems like on some of the records that, like, you were kind of struggling for years with how you fit into the world.
Well, aren't we all? Aren't we all?
Yeah. Yeah, to some degree. I mean, more so, I think, when you're younger.
Yeah.
Because the solo record, what was that for you? I mean, what was there? Did you know, like, who were the guys playing on that? On the Year of No Returning?
Some people. It was a lot of me playing a bunch of different parts.
Yeah.
And stuff that I, you know, never really played lead guitar before that exactly.
Yeah.
Or if a chord basher. But it was, the thing was that I moved into this house with some new people that I kind of just met, friends of friends.
Where?
In Chicago.
Back home?
In Lincoln Square.
Yeah.
Yeah. After like kind of basically 2 years of straight touring and almost not really having a home a lot of
with
the time.
Harpoons?
With the Harpoons. And then I moved into this house in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, let's take some time off from touring. And at the top of the house, the guy who became my new producer and bandmate, Tim Sandusky, he had built this home studio.
Uh-huh.
And I kept going up there and looking around and being like, I gotta do something in here.
Yeah.
And I kind of went into this antisocial period of like, I just want to be a megalomaniac about a recording.
Uh-huh.
And make all the decisions myself. No band democracy, no voting on which song is the best. Like, I'm just going to make a really insular thing.
Yeah.
I liked doing that. I don't know. It's also like your college friends, you've got your dynamic and you've known them for 5 years. We've been spending 24 hours in a day in a car together. And you kind of just have your old dynamic. And I was trying to break it, trying to go somewhere different.
Uh-huh. Did you think you did it?
Yeah, it was a step in a good direction.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What do you think about those old relationships that kind of held you back?
Well, they didn't, it was kind of weird just in a holding pattern at that point. I mean, the other thing about it, I guess, is that I felt pretty closeted. I felt pretty among a bunch of bros and, you know, trying to get along with the bros and
right,
kind of tamping down my queerness and my, I mean, like,
but they knew or they didn't?
I mean, they knew I told them that I was bisexual.
Yeah.
But like, I was just still saturated in the broiness and the, like, I didn't really have many gay friends, and I was just kind of, there was something culturally suffocating me a little bit. It was me just like refusing to tell anyone where I was at ever, and just like in any room I would walk into, I would just try to either be invisible or make everybody more, the most comfortable possible,
right,
take on their
right
way of speaking.
Right, right. Yeah. Just sort of like, zealot it a little bit, like kind of like, you know, just adapt to whatever the flow is. And, you know, you kind of, it's a boundary thing where you just sort of like become kind of absorbed to protect yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it over the years, it never seemed like a big enough deal to like have a, that's the thing that I think not everybody talks about coming out. Like, for some people, it's like you tell everybody, it's a big moment, and
right,
it's a big break with the past of being closeted.
Yeah.
And then, but for a lot of people, it's just like sloppy, and you mentioned some stuff to some people, but like it's not really clear where you're at, and
yeah,
you don't know, and they don't know, and there's a lot of alienation and like distance from people, and kind of tacit dishonesty, and it's just habits that I had to break.
Well, you had to make a clear decision for yourself somehow. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I mean, I can only imagine it that you know, the it's the not wanting to make waves thing,
yeah,
or the the risk of losing the affection or friendship of people, you know, must hang loom pretty large.
Yeah, and you don't know, you just don't know if they're gonna hurt you.
Yeah,
you know, or
whether they will go away, right?
Yeah.
But these bros must have been okay. These guys you were traveling with.
They were great.
Yeah.
They're
not bad bros.
No, not at all. It was more of a me thing. And yeah. Then I think I just feel like making that solo record, all these moves I made in my personal life were mirrored by the musical choices I was making. Like deciding I need to go somewhere and be alone and make a record kind of mostly alone.
Uh-huh.
Was like taking some time to figure out what's going on with me.
Right.
And then I just like started coming out and more. I started dressing feminine in public and you know, wearing dresses or makeup, and I started on stage first.
Yeah.
Because it seemed easier.
Sure.
You know, it's just a show.
It's still vague.
Right.
Yeah,
you don't know if it's a thing about
David
who I
Johansson,
am.
Anybody. Bowie. Right. You know, it's like makeup and rock and roll is fine.
Yeah. Sometimes it's a political statement. You don't have to commit if you're on stage.
Well, so the year of no returning was the beginning of you kind of, in your mind, coming out publicly in your music and in general.
Slowly. Yeah, it was sort of a step toward that.
Right. So that's 2012. And certainly by Perpetual Motion people, you're pretty, you know,
it's
you're
pretty
dressing up.
Yeah, sure. I'm in a dress on the record cover. Writing about gender and stuff. That's a whole weird thing because years and years of like playing dive bars and like being a very obscure band.
Yeah.
Nobody really cared about us. And we had this like weird moment where we had a hit song in Austria. We went to Austria like 3 times.
Which song?
It was called Take Off Your Sunglasses from...
Oh, yeah, that's a good song. Yeah.
Yeah, and they really adored
that. What was that, Day of the Dog? Which album?
No, that was
earlier?
From Inside the Human Body, the second Harpoons album.
Oh, really? Okay.
So that like kind of kept us alive. But then like it's like just mostly like playing shows and like people not coming a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And even when Day of the Dog came out, like people didn't care.
Yeah.
But then it was that record. Somehow it connected. And the funny thing is I was just about to quit at that point.
Of course.
I actually had quit. I had decided in my mind that I think it's over.
Uh-huh.
Being a touring musician, I can't take this anymore. Yeah.
And you've been at it for a few years by then.
Yeah, like 7 years.
Yeah.
7 years of touring a ton.
Yeah.
A ton. I mean, yeah, this kind of thing when musicians give their personal history and stuff, I would always listen to it and be like, what did you actually do? What did you do first? And then what did you do after that? Because like a lot of people are like, I don't know. Well, this happened and somehow lucked into this and it just kind of happened.
Right.
But for us, it was like the lucky thing was we got that first record deal. We never expected it. Then we just played shows forever.
Yeah.
For with 7 years.
Yeah.
And then that band broke up. I formed a new band.
Then Sandusky comes into your life. Is that his name?
Tim Sandusky.
Yeah, in the upstairs studio.
Yeah.
Changes the game. He plays with you now still?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. He plays the saxophone.
Uh-huh.
And
There's a like some stuff on, I don't remember which album, but there's some out there sax work on a couple of records.
He does wonderful things.
Yeah, yeah.
I found out that he played saxophone after I'd known him for it and recorded a little bit with him. And I was like, oh my God, we need this. Saxophone used to be the, like, before every band had like a lead guitar player, like in the 50s, they'd all have a sax solo, like a ripping sax solo. Right, I love that stuff.
Yeah. You got a real thing for 50s music.
Yeah. I've been trying to break that habit a little bit. With this new music,
I don't know. I just listened to the new single. It's not quite 50s, but it's definitely a 3/4.
It's a 3/4. Yeah.
All right. So okay. So you're gonna quit, and all of a sudden you're big in England.
All of a sudden, yeah. And I still was gonna quit. I was like, yeah, okay. We got some.
Everyone's gonna quit.
5-star review. I don't care. I've been through too much. It's over. I'm gonna move on to some other new phase of my life.
Yeah.
And then I felt bad. Like I've been like dragging my band through the mud, and I was like, well, we should take this trip to Europe. I should give them the trip to Europe. I can't cancel
this
that.
New band, the Boyfriends.
Yeah. So yeah. It was gonna be the last tour, and then we're like on tour in England, and like every show sells out, and like people know the words, you know. It's just like a whole kind of just like the thing that I dreamed of, you know, for the first few years before I gave up on that ever happening.
Yeah.
And we kind of had this night where I stayed up in this hotel room with Tim, and we're just like, this actually might not be the time to quit. It might be getting interesting now.
Yeah, you're a real genius. You ain't figured that out. Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, we sold out all the shows. Maybe we're finally onto something.
Yeah, and
that's exciting.
The mood all changed. I mean, it still was a ton of like, I don't know, somehow the way we do it, it's always like, we just work really fucking hard.
Yeah, you know? Well, I mean, it's a tough gig, man.
We scheduled maybe too many shows, you know, and just like pound the pavement.
All right, so now what happens? You're about to go on the road. You're about to drop a new record.
Yeah.
And this is going to be your seventh full-length record.
Seventh, yeah.
In one form.
Not counting like the little other releases.
And yeah, yeah.
EPs and B-side
right.
collections and stuff, but...
It's a lot of records.
It'll be the seventh. I know. I think it's like being a Beatles fan. You're like, they did two records a year, man. We got to keep putting them out. Yeah, I just write a lot. I love.
You still do the one song a week thing?
No, I don't. I started to realize that was making me write a ton of bad songs. And then I'd have to like sort through them and be like, I think there was a good one in here
right,
somewhere.
Right, right. Yeah, 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 yeah.
So like I'm sort of trying to take more time on each one and really... Treat them like a writer writing a piece of literature.
Which one did I just listen to? What's on your website, the new song?
Probably Love You So Bad.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good song.
With the cellos. Just cellos and drums, that one.
Yeah, it's good. Like, it's a good story. It's relatable to everybody. It's a good...
Thank you.
It's a little sad, but it's good.
I know. I'm working on storytelling.
Yeah, are you consciously?
Yeah, I mean the new record is very characters in a setting, and you know it's not really about me and my personal life so much anymore.
Oh yeah, so is it a concept record?
I have this like hesitation. It is. Uh-huh. I would say pretty much it is.
Uh-huh.
I've been hesitant to say concept record about it because that makes you think of. I don't know. It ain't a rock opera. It doesn't really have a story, an arc of a story, but it's a situation.
It's called Transangelic.
Transangelic Exodus.
Uh-huh. Where'd that title come from?
Well, a few places, but this song, which is the first song on the record called Suck the Blood from My Wound, just kind of dropped into my head. I like found this song in my brain, which for some reason was about an angel escaping from a hospital, and me and the angel, you know, driving in a car, trying to escape a hostile government, an authoritarian takeover. Which, like, the undertones here are not that hard to understand, you know, of just paranoia about a government gone bad, and what they might do to vulnerable people. So then I kind of just like had written this song. Like, I guess I have to deal with this. What is this idea that I've uncovered? And so most of the record is set in a car escaping hostile authorities. Me and my damaged angel.
Huh. You're bloodied in songs throughout your career.
Is that right?
A little bit.
There's a lot of blood and guts imagery, huh?
Yeah, fighting.
Yeah. Well, I took it from Lucinda Williams, I think, mostly. Yeah, I don't know if you're into Lucinda Williams at all.
I love her. I talked to her in here. I love her.
Oh, you did? Yeah. Oh, I shouldn't hear that.
Yeah, she's great.
She can really write a visceral image, you know?
Yeah, it's good. So how does it end up with you and the beat up angel?
You know, I think that's part of why it's not a rock opera. It's not a story. It's a perpetual situation of perpetual paranoia and flight from
hostile
authority.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. You feel that in your day-to-day life?
Yeah, kind of. I think there's a deep paranoia and siege mentality thing that's just in me.
Yeah.
From just, I don't know, growing up closeted queer.
Yeah.
And now, you know, current events are certainly aggravating that tendency in me.
Sure. And you're living in Berkeley though now, right?
I'm living in Berkeley, California.
You have a good community up there? Yeah, friends.
Yeah, and, yeah, right. Yeah.
It's definitely a city of fighters.
I'm in love with somebody who is a grad student, a PhD candidate at UC Berkeley in political theory.
Oh, really?
So I'm hanging out with a lot of people talking about talking about stuff like authoritarianism and.
So that's playing on you.
Little bit.
Yeah.
My partner wanted me to mention that they're a big fan.
Oh, good. Well, that's
nice. Of your show. And actually, I am too.
Well, thank you.
Since back in like 2010 or something, I've been listening to this.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. On the pretty regular, not every episode.
Sure.
A bunch of them.
Well, thank you. So how long you been with this person?
A while.
Yeah?
A while. We met in at Tufts.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we haven't been together that whole time. There was breakups and move aways, and we ended up together.
That's a nice story.
It's
so far. That's a good story. That's a long time, man.
It's.
So was he like the first, and now he's the he comes back around?
Kind of. Yeah.
Not many people honor that. But you've come back.
Sometimes you gotta break up to understand what it's like to break up, and then be like, "Oh, we shouldn't have done that."
Oh, wow,
that was an idiotic move.
That's great. Now, the tour. So, what are you going to do to take care of yourself?
That's the question of the hour.
Are you druggy? Do you drink too much? What do you do?
I'm very mild on all that stuff.
Yeah, well, that's good.
I mean, I can feel myself when I start to get compulsive with drinking a little bit. I can see that's like, be careful.
Yeah.
But I think I was saved from being like an addict or anything by being just a very fearful person.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm an alarmist.
If
I have a bunch of emails to answer, I'm like, I don't want to answer these emails. I'm going to like drink 3 beers.
Yeah.
Then I'm like, I'm out of control. I got to get, what's going on with me? I'm
an alcoholic. That's all it takes, huh?
So like, I just like get very afraid of it very quickly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's good.
It's a saving grace.
Fear is good in that situation.
Yeah.
But do you have a plan to somehow make this a good experience?
I think I got to remember to, if I need to just lie on a hotel bed for an hour instead of going see my friend who's in town, maybe I'll just lie on the bed for an hour and I'll see them another time.
And have you been to all the cities you're going to before?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Actually, we're going to New Orleans, which we never played in New Orleans, which is surprising to me.
That's a trippy place. Have you been there?
I've never been there, actually.
It's got its own vibe entirely.
I've been...
Like you feel it, like you know.
I've heard things, and
you get into the city, you're like, "There's no place like this place."
Yeah, that's what I hear. I mean, and also it's particularly musically,
of course,
you know, rich.
Yeah, good food.
Yeah, I've been to 48 American states, and one of the ones I haven't been to is Louisiana. Oddly.
So you've got what you got.
So I'll be at 49 once I go to New Orleans. The other one's Alaska. I'm not sure how I'll get up there.
You're not that far in Berkeley. Just go book a gig in Anchorage.
Just to make it the clean 50.
Yeah, why not? I do have to, I feel like I need to listen to some of your brother stuff.
Oh, yeah. It's magical. It's so, some of it's so intense. He's also a writer. He's like.
Did you guys play together when you were kids?
No, not really ever. For some reason, I was like, my parents would be like, hey, our friends are over for dinner. Come play us music, you know? And I was game.
Yeah.
And Jonah was like, I'm never going to do that. I don't know.
Yeah, I think you can tell in your styles
he's more insular or something. I have like a lot of traditionalist instincts.
Yeah, you got some pop music instincts.
Yeah, I love, this thing is, there's a lot more there. And that, three chords, you could do that for your whole life.
Oh, you're preaching to the choir, buddy. Seriously, I fucking love that shit. You know, I remember listening to your record. I'm like, what is this guy? He's just nailing it. It was great talking to you. I'm happy to meet you.
Great talking to you, Mark.
Have a good tour.
Thanks.
Okay. Go listen to him. Go listen to Ezra. It's good. It's good. You'll like it. And I'm not hard selling. I'm just saying I like it. So that was Ezra Furman, the new album, Transangelic Exodus, comes out February 9th. Oh, man. Am I playing guitar? Am I playing guitar? Boomer lives.